I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. My guest today is Eric Shepard, Executive Director of the Waco Civic Theater. He discusses all things drama in Central Texas, the ways the musical Hamilton is changing the industry, and how community theaters can bounce back even stronger, both during and after COVID-19. But before that conversation, it's the Small Business Spotlight, presented by American Bank. Pura Vida is one of the most commonly heard phrases in Costa Rica. Similar to how Hawaiians use aloha, Pura Vida is a greeting and a goodbye, a reminder to pursue pure life or simple life. It's about drowning out the noise and focusing on the present moment, the only moment we're guaranteed. Erin Ward knows the power of the present. She lives it every day on the dock beneath Buzzard Billy's, where she operates Pura Vida Paddle and leads groups through aquatic yoga classes while construction crews work to widen I-35.
I try to make this kind of feel like a Costa Rican vibe. So when people come, we have music playing, we have fans going. It's kind of like a lake house feel. You come, you just kick off your shoes, and you can hang out or you can go on the water. It doesn't matter.
Erin and her husband, Blake, fell in love with stand-up paddleboarding on a Colorado trip in 2016. She wanted to open a paddling business in her hometown of Waco, but there was just one problem. The Wards and their two kids lived in Lavernia, Texas, just outside of San Antonio.
My husband thought I was crazy because I'm kind of the free spirit, but then he started praying about it, and then he felt a push for it as well. So basically, in August of 2016, I came up with the name, and we just felt we were supposed to do this. So I started visiting Waco every weekend just to kind of get my connections, figure out where.
While walking along the riverfront, a friend pointed out that the bottom floor of Buzzard Billy's was vacant. Erin pitched the idea of the paddleboard and kayak rentals to the manager and then to the partners, one of whom runs a construction company and just so happened to be an avid paddler himself.
He kind of knew what we needed, so he basically redid the stairs, put more decking down here, even did a drop down into the water for us. So it's kind of what I call one of those God things, where it's just kind of like the timing, just everything happened at the right time.
Waco Paddle Company, owned by Ross Harris of the Bear Mountain, was the first to the river in March 2017. Offering canoe and kayak rentals under the west side of the Franklin Avenue Bridge. To differentiate her business, Erin uses her training as a yoga instructor to create a unique aquatic workout experience.
My most common people that come down have never done paddleboarding and never done yoga, which actually blows my mind that they've never done any of this, but they're just adventurous people. So I have some classes where we never even stand up. It's completely, you know, go to our knees, sitting down, meditation, relaxation, things like that. But then you get some of those people that are going to like, hey, let's go for it. So we'll have fun with it. And I mean, the worst case scenario, it's water. Have you ever jumped into a lake or have you ever jumped into a river? It's not like, it's actually the best place to fall.
Many small businesses could not find a soft landing spot to fall during COVID. Pura Vida experienced a hiccup too, with the restaurant closing and Waco's tourist numbers dropping. So Erin took part of her 50 craft fleet to her neighborhood and started advertising kayak rentals for pickup.
And there was no touching, there wasn't anything. I would sanitize everything, I would put everything out in the yard, and they literally would just pick it up and take it to go. And I didn't know what that would do, but actually it was really busy. I think after being quarantined for a month too though, and people were like, what? Yeah, give me a kayak. So that actually worked out really well, which was really awesome social distancing, socializing at my house.
Erin has published the company's fall hours, which for the first time includes evening paddling sessions on Wednesdays and Thursdays in addition to weekend fun. Like every other small business owner in the country, she's throwing an idea up on the wall.
Usually when school hits, just things start dying down, extracurricular activities, so it's not worth it. But right now, just some people are homeschooling. Also, maybe if they get off work. Honestly, it's the best social distancing you can do. So we're trying it.
And hoping the community helps it stick. Or in this case, float. The Small Business Spotlight is presented by American Bank, with three locations in town, including an expanded branch at Franklin and 4th. I'm now joined in studio by Eric Shepard, the executive director of the Waco Civic Theater. Welcome to Downtown Depot.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you, Austin.
Great to see you, too. Now, tell our listeners, Eric, what is your Waco history?
My Waco history goes way back to my sophomore year of high school when a local radio station in Austin, where I grew up, gave away a week-long workshop to KWBU. So I came up 4 weeks, stayed in the dorms, ate in the cafeterias, and said, I like Baylor. This is really cool. I didn't get off the campus, but I sure liked Baylor. And then when I was teaching high school and using drama in the classroom, I ran across the director of the Baylor Theater Master's Degree Program. And he invited me to attend Baylor in the late 90s. And Waco was different then.
I've heard that.
Yes, right, right. But it was on its way up. Baylor had just joined the Big 12. And so there were, you know, lots of hopes that, you know, great things would happen. And then before I finished grad school, I got a job in Killeen running their theater. And I kind of kept in touch with, you know, Waco friends along the way. A number of Baylor grads had worked at Waco Civic Theater. And then when the job came open in late fall of 2012, I applied. And so I started working at Waco Civic Theater in January of 2013 and have loved every bit of it.
I've heard great reviews of a performance of Matilda that's happening at the theater in Killeen right now.
Yes.
It seems like there's a lot of cross-pollination between that theater community and the community here in Waco.
There always has been some, but it ramped up about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. In the summer of 2017, that theater was in danger of closing. And so I got a phone call from Killeen asking me to come down there personally. And I was like, I love my job. But we worked out a deal wherein both theaters could work together on productions. And since that time, the traffic between the two cities and the two theaters has been on the upswing. And so that production that they did, I didn't have anything to do with it. They're on their feet. They're solid. But a lot of folks from Waco were involved and are audience members now of that theater as well. So it's been a success all the way around, and I'm glad to hear that they're doing well and that people say good things about their shows.
So have you been a part of the Waco theater community consistently since the late 90s? Is that right? Or you left and came back?
Left and came back. I did a number of shows at Baylor because they sort of keep us captive there in grad school. You know, we had an upstairs attic office, and we weren't allowed to come out until we had good things to do. So it's a little insular, you know, the grad program. I did get out and see a couple of shows at Waco Civic Theater, and I was intrigued with the space because it's a unique building. It's built to have productions in almost any direction you want to face the audience. So I kept in touch a little bit over that time period from 99 to 2012, since some people that I knew from grad school, from undergrad as well, were employed or were contractors at Waco Civic Theater. So I've kept in touch. But it really ramped up when I became the director in January of 2013.
So you've been doing Waco with the theater for almost a decade now. I think that's large enough to have a representative sample size. How would you assess the theater scene in Waco and the talent who was coming to audition 8 years ago as you would today?
One of the things that is unfortunately true about a lot of community theater is that it tends to be a little closed environment, right? And some of it has to do with the reliability factor. There are certain actors that show up time after time, and you know you can count on them coming, right? There's also the familiarity aspect wherein audiences tend to like to see the same performer in a variety of parts over the years. And what that can do is unconsciously kind of reinforce the amateur in amateur theater. And as I looked at the work that happened before I got to Waco Civic Theater, I noticed that some of the highest quality work was done when someone from the outside came in, because that allowed new people to come to the theater and their connections to bring new life into the theater. And sometimes it was the very same actors, but with an outside voice, they were able to achieve greater things. Or in the case of one of the directors who contracted there quite frequently, he had a lot of professional theater connections, and he was able to bring people in, people who decided, you know, they just want to do George a favor, or, you know, they thought, hey, this would be kind of fun. What has happened since I've been involved is that more and more, because of the growth of Waco, because of the growth of Baylor, because our work has gotten better, is that we regularly have people who could and have and may still work professionally at our theater. And then we have the group of people who could have worked professionally. I'm thinking of a doctor here in town who could have sung professionally. Golden voice. But, you know, he's doing the right thing, especially in COVID times. You wouldn't want to take him away from his office or his practice at all. But he could work professionally quite easily. And in his schedule, he's got time. And for folks like that who want to volunteer, they have to feel that their time would be really well spent, that the production is going to be a good one, and that they're going to work with similarly devoted people. And I think that is what has happened over the years, is that even the people who are not doing show after show after show are more likely to do one with us because they know that they're going to get to work with other people who are as devoted and as talented as they are. And what's also true is that Baylor provides a really great influx on a regular basis for all sorts of folks. We have a Baylor professor who used to work professionally, now teaches in the English department, and she does a show or two a year with us. We have another Baylor theater professor, actually has two master's degrees, and she does a show or two per year. Another woman who's professionally trained and a union member, equity member, but because of her life and work situation doesn't practice theater professionally, but she will music direct or she'll act in our shows. And there are all sorts of those kinds of people. And we've been really blessed, really lucky that those kind of folks are attracted to our theater. And that's what makes it more rewarding, and which leads to more audience, which leads to, you know, better shows. And it sort of feeds on itself.
Well, and you're always ratcheting it up a notch.
Yes.
When you have someone who brings new influence in. And I do think that the gravity of Baylor cannot be understated. There is nowhere else in the country where there's a city of 150,000 people and Yo-Yo Ma is coming to perform.
Yeah.
Or like my guest last week on Downtown Depot is the certified executive pastry chef, Michelle Brown, who mm-hmm. heads the culinary arts department at TSTC. She's one of, I think, four chefs in the entire world. After we recorded, she got an award that made her like literally one of four people in the whole world that have this designation. And she happens to be here in Waco. And I do think that the pull of Baylor allows for premier talent to come on, and mm-hmm. then everybody else can take pages from that playbook, right?
Yes. And I think, by and large, you know, the economy of Waco is really helpful, too. I mean, it's an inexpensive place to live. It's pretty scenery, you know, and except for August, the weather's pretty good, you know. yeah, there's lots of factors there. Baylor's a huge one. When I worked in Killeen, we mentioned that theater a while ago. One of the things that helped that theater in a, you know, similarly sized town achieve great things was the military. You know, and that was a big contributor to the economy and a big contributor to the talent level that one would have down there. Here in Waco, we have Baylor and TSTC and MCC, all of which help us, you know, in our work to achieve higher things because the professors, you know, are there and their students are there and their spouses are there. And we have a really nice confluence of factors that allow us to achieve, punch beyond our weight, you know, so to speak.
The theater business as an industry has taken a major hit during COVID.
Ouch.
Broadway has been shut down completely. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that the theater is in a position where you purchased rights to put on these performances, and now you're unable to do so.
Right.
What is the, you know, without getting too much into the nitty-gritty,
sure,
like, what is the outlook of community theaters, and what does the community need to know about how we can support Waco Civic?
I think community theaters are in many ways in a much better position than professional theaters. One of the reasons being that we are likely to be more attuned to local conditions because this is where we live. We're less in community theaters. We find it less necessary to deal with unions and industry contracts that prevent us from being able to work in certain ways. You know, the 15-minute smoke break, we just don't do that, right? You know, you got to have it, you know. And if you're a union member, you pay your dues and, you know, you get your pair of shoes and your health insurance. We don't have to worry about that stuff, right? We can just do theater because we love it and because we're devoted to the craft. One of the other things that's different about us as well is the scale of the work that we do. So on Broadway, if you were to go see a show now, you might be able to do a show because of local health restrictions in New York, and I'm not sure if that's even possible. But let's take the union aside. Let's take, you know, let's say that the pandemic has abated enough that it's safe to congregate. Well, 50% in a Broadway house feels empty. and you cannot pay the bills. You know, it's a minimum of $500,000 a week to afford a Broadway show, with all of the merchandising, with all of the investors that have to be paid back, real estate. You know, cost of doing business is incredibly high. And shows that are making $500,000 a week in ticket sales, which would be our year, you know, would have to fold up shop. And so we're in a better position than professional theaters in so many aspects. I think one of the things that has been gratifying in a way, or has softened the blow, is that we're all in the same boat. You know, the Dallas Theater Center, the Alley Theater in Houston, and, you know, all the Schubert Theaters in New York, we're all closed. And the West End, you know, in London, we're all in the same boat. And that has helped spread out the pain, if you will, you know. And it's also meant that we've rethought our industry as well. What is absolutely necessary? One of the things that we have taken for granted is tickets. But tickets mean we're exchanging stuff with people, right? And the possibility exists that we could give them a germ, you know. So we're going to go to purely electronic ticketing. Same with playbills. For time immemorial, people have wanted to carry that playbill, that little tiny magazine, with them, you know. And it has been a change for us, and will be a change for many theaters. We'll just do them electronically. You'll download it on your phone or your tablet, you know, whatever device you've got. And then you're responsible for the content, and it changes a couple things for us. It means we don't have to spend money on printing, right, which was a big cost. We don't have to spend time trying to sell people on the idea that this advertising is going to work, because nearly all of us lose money on our playbills. But now we don't have to worry about that, right? And we're giving them a better product, because on your phone, you can look at it and you can see the Marsh Construction Company, for instance, you know, has supported Waco Civic Theater. Well, now I'm not just looking at a static ad or a picture of a logo. I can actually press on my phone or my tablet, and I'll go to the Marsh's website. And if I have a construction project in mind, I can contact them right there from my phone in front of the show. So some of the things have been losses, but they are gains wrapped up in losses. Rights and royalties, the publishing houses have been great about. And one of the other big changes that's happened that to me is a game changer for community theater in particular is streaming. And we're getting into that. We've ordered cameras, and the industry has done a complete 180. The contracts that we had with Samuel French or Rodgers and Hammerstein or whomever would all tell us we have to put a warning in the playbill that says, and in capital letters, no recording of any kind, right? And now all the contracts say, would you like to apply to put this online or to, you know, broadcast?
Really?
It's a complete change. And about 95 to 98% of all the musical theater and non-musicals out there are now available for streaming. So if I want to do, I don't know, To Kill a Mockingbird or Our Town or One Man, Two Governors, I have a little box I can check that says I want to apply for a streaming license. And, you know, in almost every case, they're granted. So that has changed a lot. And that will allow people who don't feel they want to expose themselves to a crowd to go to the theater. But for us in the community theater, one of the things that happens is we cast someone in a show and they have, you know, an aunt, an uncle, a cousin who lives in Florida. And they're like, do I want to drive to Texas to see this play? Can you just send me a recording? No, I'm sorry, uncle. We're not allowed to make recordings. So no, we can't send that to you. And they go, maybe we'll just sit this one out, right? But now they can go on our ticketing portal and they can watch their nephew or whomever do that show in a way that's never been possible before.
That is an incredible opportunity. I do think that this whole COVID period we're going through gives us a real chance to remake the world our own little businesses in some ways. And I do think that it's encouraging to hear that the community theater model is maybe in a better position than the professional theater model is, because the gospel that I preach on Downtown Depot is small iterative steps. Like, let's make small bets on ourselves. If you spend $500,000 for a week of production, you can't do that. But if you're spending $5,000 a show, you can put that on and you can run that, you know, you can run that string out. So I'm happy to hear that that's where our community theater is in Waco. And you're hearing from Eric Shepard, the executive director of the Waco Civic Theater. Everybody, when talking about streaming, has heard of or watched Hamilton.
Yes,
on Disney
right.
Plus now.
Exactly, yeah.
And Hamilton itself is a pretty revolutionary play.
Yes.
In the performers are rapping. Mm-hmm. I actually read a piece about it that Hamilton has seven times the amount of words
as
a normal Broadway play would of its length.
Right.
And so you come away from watching this And it's just so heavy because you just got dumped so much knowledge on you, but it was done in such an artful and graceful way that you sat through the most exciting two-hour history class in the world. Do you see more diversity coming in terms of the types of plays that people expect? Like, has Hamilton potentially opened up a new part of Broadway, a new part of theater that other people ordinarily wouldn't have thought would exist on a stage?
Absolutely. Let me tell you, first of all, that I heard Hamilton soundtrack for the first time on KWBU. NPR did a preview of it way back in like 2015, and I was driving. I was still living in Temple at the time, and I got in my car and I started to listen to the soundtrack, and I just kept driving and driving it because I couldn't turn it off. You know, it was such a revelation, and I had a little bit of skepticism, you know, about it. Like, okay, a rap musical. Well, I like that. A rap musical about Alexander Hamilton? Yeah, okay, I got to hear this, you know. But the hype or the buzz on it was such that I said, I have to listen to it. I have to make this judgment for myself. And I think it did the same for a lot of people in that it was an unfamiliar way of telling the story. And it was also done in a way, you know, where basically all the performers in the show are actors of color, right? And so you have, you know, a black man playing Thomas Jefferson, who's a noted slave owner, you know? And you go, how does that work? How can I make that work? And, you know, on one level you go, okay, it's all make-believe, right? Anyway, that...
We're acting.
Yes, that's right. That guy up there is not really killing anybody. It's a murder mystery. No one really got killed, and we're happy about that, right? So we're willing to go along. We have this willing suspension of disbelief, you know, the phrase goes. So, okay, why can that not extend to skin color as well? I think that the entertainment industry follows the world in a way, and it leads the world in a way. I think it was revolutionary to think about an art form that practiced the way that Hamilton is in all its respects. But they broke ground other ways, too. They were giving away, they were doing lottery tickets, you know. So a ham for a ham. So $10 was your entry fee into lottery, and you would get a $10 ticket if your number was picked. Because, you know, Broadway tickets are a minimum of $100, right? And so it just typed out so many audience members, and they said, $10 is something reasonable. We can't guarantee that, you know, and we can't return the money to the investors and pay the rent and all that, but we can give away a lot of seats at $10 a piece and still make the return that needs to be made, and we'll have full houses. One of the other things that they did, the production company, is they shared the proceeds of the show with the actors. Because typically what happens is, you know, actors are successful, but they see very, very little of the success of Broadway musicals. It's more common in Hollywood, less common on Broadway. And so now that's changed. What's also true is that with the Me Too movement and with Black Lives Matter, what we're seeing is that what really matters in telling stories is who they're by, who they're for, and who gets to make the decisions. And that's the most important part, is that if you have women, like in Waitress, who are the entire creative team, then they have positions of power to influence other women's careers, and they're going to tell the story differently than a committee of men, right? And if you have stories like, people love Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, but there were a couple of white guys from New York City writing about life in the South Pacific, right? In South Pacific, right?
Sure.
And nowadays we go, well, that doesn't quite compute, does it, right? So Hamilton has also helped change that narrative and that way of looking at the world, in that we need to hear those voices, and we need to hear stories about the people whose stories we don't know, told by those people instead of interpreted, you know, through whatever the existing power structure was, which tended to be overwhelmingly white, right, and East Coast. So Hamilton has changed the world in a lot of ways, in a lot of really great ways, and I'm all about it. I mean, it is exciting to think about theater being practiced a different way from soup to nuts, you know. It may not be the be all and end all, but it certainly did catalyze a lot of awareness and change, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, it's sort of like if you get a Guggenheim Fellowship or a MacArthur Genius Grant, and you have enough money to really practice your craft, by giving these actors part of the box or part ownership in the production, however it was structured, we're allowing someone like David Diggs to say, hey, you don't just have to take the next deal that your agent gives you because you need the money.
Right.
We're going to give you some rope so that you can really go out and you can be creative. And ultimately, that's what we want. We want our artists being largely free from restrictions, and we can be the patron and allow them to produce.
Yeah, if you watch Netflix or you watch Amazon Prime, it's a little less true on Hulu, but if you watch those streaming services, it's interesting to watch who the producers are, because more and more you're seeing actors being producers mm-hmm. in their own shows. And it's also true in the music industry. The more you're able to control the process by which your ideas get to the outside world, the closer you're going to be to the vision that you had. And that means that there is diversity. That means that we're not recycling the same plot or the same, you know, three chords or the same way of constructing a story over and over again. And it doesn't matter whether you're a performer of color or not. It matters if you're an artist. You want to be able to see your work created in a form as close as possible to the way you thought of it, because that has impact. And I love that part about what's going on in the world, too. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes, you know, winning a Tony or an Emmy or an Oscar or something to get that kind of clout. But as we are able to produce more and more work in our basement, you know, or in our office, that has become less and less true. And new voices are being heard because they have the means of production available to them. It's pretty great.
This weekend at Waco Civic Theater is going to be a new production, the Storybook Waco Variety Hour.
Yes.
It is a fundraiser for the theater happening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. What could listeners of Downtown Depot expect, and how could they go about getting tickets to attend?
Well, you can go to our website, wacocivictheater.org, and the setup is outdoors. Everyone will be masked, including our staff, but the performers will be socially distanced on an outdoor stage, and there will be lots of room in the audience for families to come or individuals to come, and you'll have zones where, you know, you'll be 6 feet away from anyone else. And fingers crossed, the FM broadcast station that we purchased is going to be up and running, so you can actually see the show in your car, you know.
Like a drive-in movie theater
like
situation.
Like a drive-in movie. And that's one of the directions we're moving. You know, you want to be small so you can be agile, right?
Exactly. The small bets. Make small bets on yourself. It's
yes.
easy to change.
Right. So we hope to be able to broadcast at low power FM broadcast for people who want to stay in their cars while folks who are sitting on the lawn can watch the show as well.
So find Waco Civic Theater online and on Facebook. Check out the Storybook Waco Variety Hour this weekend and do what you can to support community theater in Waco. Eric Shepherd is the executive director of the Waco Civic. Thank you so much for coming on Downtown Depot.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Thanks again to Eric Shepherd, Aaron Ward of Pura Vida Paddle, American Bank, and you for tuning in. The Storybook Variety Hour premieres outside at Waco Civic Theater tonight at 8 p.m. and runs through Sunday. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Waco Business News to stay updated in between episodes, and keep the dial tuned to Waco's NPR for more terrific local and national content. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.